Hello and welcome to Next 2.0 on WQLN NPR. I'm your host, Marcus Atkinson. Next is produced by the Public's Voice Media. I'm here with my guest host, Chuck Camerata. If you want to know more about Next 2.0, go to Facebook, like the page. You can also follow us on Instagram at Next 2.0. There you can keep up with upcoming show promos, events, and clips about what's next for our communities and our democracy. Thank you so much for tuning in. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is one of those shows where you can't not do it. You can't not talk about it. I went around and around in circles, and not comparing these but in terms of subject matter at all, but I went around and around in circles for years on WQLN before I decided to tackle abortion, only because I knew it was one of those subjects where you don't change people's minds. You know, you enrage people on one side or the next. Everyone kind of has their heels dug in terms of what they think about this particular topic. And there are very few things or subjects as or more complicated than that. Enter the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yeah.
And it is just so ridiculously difficult to try to decipher, detangle, understand. There's so many layers to it. You've got the religious side of it, I'll say, and that side of this conversation brings all sorts of things into it. You know, I've had conversations with pastoral friends of mine. They're giving me their perspective on where this started. You'll listen to some Jewish scholars, and some take it back that far, some don't. You know, everyone has an opinion. I think for the first time in a long time with this particular conflict, I've seen a lot of organizations that are African-American-led that are making pro-Palestinian speeches and stances, and then millennials are making a lot of pro-Palestinian stances, and people are like, what's that about? I watch one pastor on YouTube, and he had a huge American flag and a huge Israeli flag flying from the stage of his church, which for me is problematic, but I'll leave that alone. And he proceeded to read his Millennials the Riot Act about them supporting Palestine, and they need to get their facts straight. And it was a pro-Israeli speech, 1,000,000,000% from the pulpit on a Sunday morning.
Yes.
To a congregation shaking their heads like, amen, you tell them, Pastor, you tell them. Yep. It's a complicated topic.
It sure is. You got history, you got religion, you got you got geopolitical issues that are part of it. Yet, ethnic issues.
It's
complicated as can be, and I think we might just strike the greatest balance of the issues that we've talked about in the past on this one, where we don't just tick off people on one side of
That's
the
right.
issue, but we can do both on this one.
And really, this the purpose of the show is to just analyze what's going on amongst ourselves. The seeking to understand is continual, at least for me it is, right?
Yeah.
And so let me give you my pre-interview speech. Don't email me saying you should have said. Don't email me saying, oh, man, why did you say it? We are acknowledging on the front end. It's complicated, and we just want to talk about it because it's not just news. It is news that affects seemingly the entire world. Everyone has an opinion. And so in order to help us unpack this and do it some sort of justice is our friend, and we actually do some things with Next with Penn State Barron through this partnership that I've had with Dr. Lena Sersker-Harnett. Am I saying it right? Yes. She came on before and helped us really unpack some things with this issue in Ukraine. Lena, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Political science major at Penn State Barron.
Yes.
Professor. Give us your background at Penn State Barron, what you do, what your degree is in, your passion for this subject matter.
Oh, sure. Thank you again for having me, as always. I enjoy our conversations. And in full disclosure, I am not an expert on Middle Eastern politics, but I am a professor of political science. I teach comparative politics, international relations, and my background is quite varied, but ethnic conflict, of course, part of it. And of course, I've been very much involved in analyzing Russia-Ukraine relations because I am indeed Ukrainian. And it was my pleasure speaking to you about that. At Penn State Barron, I am an associate teaching professor of political science, associate director of public policy initiative. And that is the initiative you mentioned that we are partnering through with Public Voice. Yeah, and I've been there for 7 years, and my students have been asking a lot of questions, and I just had a nice conversation involving my other colleagues that cover variety of topics and variety of subjects around the world, where we tackled just this issue about 10 days ago, about 2 weeks ago, because students are asking questions. And I think you're absolutely right. The difficulty of the situation is not just that it's historically difficult, religiously difficult. It's very emotional. Mm-hmm. And it's very emotional right now for people because of the scale and cruelty and the amount of brutality and, of course, the civilian casualties. Mm-hmm. And that is something that brings out a lot of emotion and a lot of gut responses from people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you look at the footage on the news, how do you not get emotional? You see all of these children and elderly people caught in the middle of this conflict. And like anything else, you know, your heart goes out from a human perspective, and then you start to try to peel back the layers.
Yep.
I was saying to our guests and to Chuck before we came on the air that I have watched umpteen documentaries on this topic. You know, the rise of Hamas, the rise of this conflict, 1948, the role of Great Britain, which trips me out a little bit that they kind of stuck their nose in and kick this thing off in some ways. I don't know if I can completely articulate it, but when I was looking at the role of Great Britain in 1948 and hacking up these territories, I thought to myself, was the goal to destabilize? But I digress. I've watched all of these different documentaries, and I've read a lot on the subject. It still just boggles my mind. What I'll say from a religious standpoint, Chuck, and from a spiritual standpoint, is if I was not a religious or spiritual person, I would still say to myself, there has to be some sort of significance about the history of these people. Hmm. Because whenever I see all of humanity have a reaction to a particular group, there's something, in my mind anyways, there's something bigger going on there.
Yeah.
So whether you believe in the Bible and in the Judaism or any of that, there's something going on in the history of these people, because there are too many people that have a reaction.
Yeah.
You know, to the history of the Jews, the plight of the Jews, what's going on in Israel, things along those lines. Before we go to the political side of it, Chuck, you've been a pastor a long time. Walk us through what this feels like and sounds like from a religious standpoint, because I would imagine you've had more than a few discussions with pastors from different backgrounds.
Discussions that often end up in the same place, which is, well, man, I don't know what we're going to do about this or what can be done about this. But religiously speaking, both traditions, Islam and Christianity and Judaism, we all trace ourselves to Abraham. If you remember the story in Genesis, Abraham is the father of Isaac and Ishmael, and Isaac becomes the progenitor of what became the Jews, and Ishmael of what became the Arabs, and hence some people trace the conflict back 3,000 years to that. And how much of that is true in terms of if that's the seed of things that are going on today, it's hard for me to know. As I look at this particular conflict, I see it happening mostly as a result of what happened in the late 1800s and the rise of Zionism, and the Jews need to have a place where they could be safe.
Yeah.
And so that part of the history, I think, is really, really relevant. I don't know anybody who can tell you whether or not the birth of Isaac and the birth of Ishmael is really the heart of this thing. But I do know that we can look at a time when the Jews were looking for a place to be safe, and this led to what we have today.
Mm-hmm. Another question on that era real quick before we move on. Can you help the listener, to the best of your ability, understand why, in general, so many Christian faiths are so diehard in support of Israel?
Yeah, I think that comes from a misunderstanding of two things. The chosenness of the election of the people of Israel by God, and that we are the new Israel as Christians. Theologically, I have issues with that, but also there is the fact that Israel plays a central role in the end of times. And so those traditions that think that have more focus on Armageddon and the end times and the return of Christ, they are much more supportive of Israel than you might find in more mainline churches that don't espouse in a big way the apocalyptic kind of belief system that led to a whole series of things that have happened since the 70s, when a guy named Hal Lindsey wrote a book, The Late Great Planet Earth, which talked about the Middle East and Israel and the oil embargoes and as the source of the coming end of the world. And it appears he was wrong about some things, but it continues to stir up people. So we have to support Israel because God supports Israel. And, mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that's true. I don't buy it personally, and that's a discussion that can be mm-hmm. had at some point. But for me, this issue really is about two peoples, the Palestinians and the Jews, both of whom you can look at and say, boy, these people have been victimized. And that the level of oppression that these two groups have suffered is amazing and depressing and horrifying. And that generates the kind of passion on both sides that we're seeing today. But I think the passion has to be aimed at we have to have compassion for both groups. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can be a supporter of Israel and still say, we got to do something for the Palestinians. And you can be a supporter of Palestinian homeland or mm-hmm. independence. But you can also say, but we have to protect the Jews from right. the rest of the world, essentially. So
even when you look at the term Christianity, you know, that there are so many different groups, ideologies, and thought processes that get put under that umbrella.
Yeah.
Right? And so I listen to or read about Hamas, for example. The actions of Hamas and the desires of the Palestinian people overall don't necessarily,
absolutely,
you know, agree a lot of times. And so even with looking at what Hamas is doing and what they're about and saying, yeah, that's the Palestinians, I would check with them on that before yeah. You know, add their name to that. I see you shaking your head.
That's what I was going to say.
Talk a little bit about that, because that's where it becomes really convoluted, because you have a group who says, in the name of these people, we're doing, is it really in the name of these? Talk about that a little bit.
So, yeah, there's quite a few things that need to be unpacked here and to keep in mind. So one thing that I wanted to jump in is the conversation about this historical justice. Right, because this conflict in many ways and why it so invokes that emotion, why we bring up history and why your example of going back to Abraham comes in, right? Because we start looking for sort of resolution to historic justice or historic injustice that's been done either on Palestinians or done on the Jewish people, and therefore we tend to sort of try to take a side. And I don't know if it's necessarily a human trait or a trait of humans in 21st century fueled by information silos and social media where we want to take sides. And we like to see things in black and white, really clearly demarcated, our guys, bad guys. And the story here is, right, that it's very difficult to pinpoint bad and good guys. Mm-hmm. But it's not that easy, not that difficult to pinpoint bad actions.
Yes.
And, you know, as I tell my students constantly and remind them, two things you need to remember about this conflict. One is that, yes, indeed, Hamas does not equal Palestine. Mm-hmm. Palestine does not equal Hamas. Mm-hmm. And two, that any attack on civilians is both illegal and unjust in any context,
right.
And immoral for that matter. Mm. And keeping sort of those principles in mind, moving forward to understand, yes, of course, it then becomes very difficult to take sides, even though we really might want to and be driven to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's an expectation that, you know, watching President Biden talk about Israel and us wanting the country to support Israel financially through this war and everything else. And then they start lumping, and again, you came and unpacked this for us before, start lumping the situation in Ukraine into it, and where we're already sending aid to Ukraine, and that's become kind of a blended conversation. You know, are there similarities, and where we draw the line that these things are just two completely different things? And should they be mentioned in the same conversation when it comes to the United States Senate financial aid?
And what a fantastic question that is. As Fiona Hill recently wrote, that might have been a good congressional politics, but it's really bad geopolitics. And I couldn't agree more with that assertions of hers. Because Russia and Ukraine are a very different story. In the sense that I can see how people can draw parallels about, especially when we start talking about colonization and occupation and attacks on civilians, right? At the bare minimum, those things sort of pop up as a conversation starters and where those two things can be blended. But Russian-Ukrainian story, I hate to tell you, but there is a bad guy. A very clear illegal action on behalf of Russian Federation of first annexing Ukrainian territory in 2014, which is absolutely illegal act under international law. And then, of course, proceeding with a slew of policies in the following 9 years, culminating, of course, in February of 22, when the full-scale invasion unfolded. And those actions are indeed illegal and immoral under any stretch of circumstances. And so far, Ukrainians are fighting on Ukrainian territory. It is Ukrainian civilians who are being murdered daily, who are being imprisoned, who are being tortured. Ukrainian citizens on the occupied territories who are going through all kinds of unspeakable horrors at the hands of Russian occupiers. And of course, the unimaginable suffering of the children who are being taken forcibly from Ukraine and deported into Russia, which is, of course, an international crime for which Putin now is indeed a wanted international criminal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So in Ukraine-Russia situation, right, why it's the things are maybe a little clearer there and a little less complicated is that there is indeed a illegal, immoral action done by one side. So talking about both sides in Ukrainian scenario, I think becomes fantastically misleading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, when you look at the global community, I think by and large, minus maybe a China,
yeah,
globally, people acknowledge that this is very true. There is a clear bad guy. They're outlining the same things that you're outlining for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, Vladimir Putin being who he is like, so? Mm-hmm. I mean, he is the consummate bad guy. But Go ahead.
But I think why it's bad geopolitics, again, to come back to Fiona Hill's assertion, is that, right, it muddies the waters. When we start talking about aid to Ukraine and aid to Israel in the same package, you sort of put them into the same category.
Yeah.
And you sort of try to make a moral equivalency between the two cases of sort of being attacked and defending, which, of course, brings up another point. Is Ukraine then more like Israel or is Ukraine is more like Palestine? When actually neither, mm-hmm. right? And any kind of moral equivalencies of that case are indeed wrong. Albeit, of course, President Biden's assertion that both Russia and Hamas are terrorists are indeed true,
mm-hmm.
are indeed factual, and I would agree with that statement wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
But geopolitically, why this is problematic then, that once people start making false equivalences of the kind, it really remarkably serves to the benefit of Vladimir Putin's agenda.
Hmm.
Right, because on one hand, it muddies the waters on Ukraine. It starts. We start hearing conversations about both siding on that conflict as well, and of course, it detracts attention.
Mm-hmm.
And it detracts attention from Ukrainian cause to a very legitimate concern in the Middle East.
Yeah. You go back to 1948, which a lot of people pinpoint as like the time when this all goes down. Chuck, to your point, late 1800s, and you've got Zionists who want to go back to this home territory. And listen, from a spiritual significance standpoint, when you look at the history of the Jews, it's not difficult to understand why this territory means so much to them.
Yeah, it took a long time for them to make the decision to really fight back. I mean, we had 1,500 years of Jews being oppressed, persecuted. Finally, in the mid to late 1800s, some Jews in places like Russia, where pogroms are wiping out Jews and kicking them out of the country, and there's no place for them to go. Finally, some people, a guy named Thomas Herzl, who wasn't a militant, wasn't a fighter, but said, there's only one solution to this. We got to have a place to go. And the world began to recognize that. So the League of Nations starts talking about that. And we start talking about how about we send them to Uganda? That was actually a thing on the table.
Yeah.
Black
folks said, nah.
because we're going to send them somewhere where we don't have to deal with them. But you can't. It was just craziness. It was just craziness because most of those countries that in the League of Nations who were making these kinds of decisions and having these discussions didn't want to have to deal with the Jews themselves. And so they're looking for a place to get rid of the Jews, especially the Europeans. And so ultimately the Jews say, we're going to go back. We're going to go back to the land.
Yeah.
And there's always been a Jewish presence in Palestine. We're going to go back. And they started buying up land there and moving there.
Right.
It was not a military thing. And then when the Holocaust comes, that's the straw that breaks the camel's back, and the world kind of recognizes we have to have a place for these folks to go.
And I cannot recall, I should have written it down, the Sheikh's name, and I'm sure that when we have our Jewish rabbi on, he'll be able to speak to this with certainty. But there's an Islamic Sheikh that sat down with Hitler and was really instrumental in some of the hostile attitudes that started to develop in that area at the time about the Jews. To go back to the era that you're talking about, when they are Zionists are looking at coming over, going back to Palestine and setting up shop, and you're right, it was just they're buying up land. It was just very normal transactions. I was shocked to find that a lot of Jewish leaders looked at it from the perspective of, no, we shouldn't go, because if we were exiled by God, let him be the one to lead us back there. I thought that was an interesting perspective that I hadn't heard before.
You have any issue on which you take some time to know the nuances, and you're going to discover, I think, that there are opinions all over the place.
Yeah.
So the Jews are wrestling with, some are saying we should go back, some are saying we shouldn't go back, some are saying we should build a military force, some are saying we should not. So, I mean, it's just, even to today, there are lots of Jews in Israel who are not supportive of Netanyahu's policies, pushing into the West Bank and settling areas and essentially dispossessing the Palestinians who are there and have been there. So there's plenty. It's hard to wrestle with a country, a people, when they are both the victim and the victimizer. And in this case, with Israel, they have become the victimizer.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of rationalization and discussion about why, but and I firmly believe that if the Palestinians put down their weapons, Hamas said no more, we're going away, that would kind of end the violence. At least it would not lead to a peaceful ultimate solution, but
which
it would end the violence.
Possible.
But if the Israelis put down their weapons, rather than there being no more violence, there would be no more Israelis. And that's a difficult position for the Israelis to be in.
Right. Which leads me back to the comment about Hamas and Palestine,
yes,
not necessarily being synonymous.
Yes.
Because from my understanding, so for a long time, many of the Palestinians felt like, you know what? You're there. We're here. Let's clearly define who's where in this region and coexist. Although deep down, we don't like each other.
Yeah.
Enter Hamas, who says, no, not just no, hell no.
That's right.
We want to see them eradicated. There's
exactly.
No option in their minds for,
right.
Well, they get this part of the territory. And they're like, no. So to your point, Chuck, just from everything I've learned about Hamas, that would be their position. Lay your guns down if you want to. We will finish the job.
So how do you negotiate with a neighbor who decides that the only purpose in life
is
to destroy
you?
Yeah, you don't negotiate with that person. So Hamas has to be removed from the equation, I think. But that's not a simple thing to do.
At all, at all. And they seem very content with, I remember a scene from New Jack City. I don't know how many people listening have ever seen that movie. But
we always get to a movie at some point.
It is. There's a scene when the bad guy, Nino Brown, played by Wesley Snipes, who did a bang-up job playing that role, by the way, played by Wesley Snipes. He is at a wedding, and they are shooting at him at a wedding, and he picks a little girl up to use as a human shield as he runs for cover. And at that moment, I'm like, you know where I'm going.
Yes, I do. By the way, we can beat things out. So,
and it made people hate Nino Brown. When you read about Hamas in some of these situations, they seem to intentionally look for opportunities to bring civilians in as human shield and to say, listen, if these people get murdered in the process, it's okay because it leads to our overall goal. Yeah. Of you have to go. The geopolitical scene, walk us through this, because you go back, I mentioned 48 and you mentioned League of Nations. Mm-hmm. Great Britain at the time come plays a role. You know, they get a hold of the territory. They start to divvy it up. They are actually regulating how many Jews can come in and settle. And, you know, it becomes a whole thing. And again, you've got this person over here talking to Hitler. Hitler's vested. Can you just give us an idea of when you have these geopolitical politics? For those that are neophytes in this space, you always have the big names come into it. And so you talk about what's going on in Ukraine, you hear Russia, and Russia's the aggressor, and then you hear China with their 2 cents. It always comes down historically. Recently, it's China. Mm-hmm. Historically, it's always been a U.S., you know, influence, Russian influence, and then now lately China. Back in the day, you know, Great Britain, mm-hmm. France. Talk about how these major players have always had some sort of influence on the outcome of these skirmishes throughout history. Give us a short tutorial on that.
Well, short tutorial probably won't happen. since, you know, when I teach international relations, I spend weeks on this topic. But in one word, it all comes down to great power politics is all about colonialism. Mm. And colonialism is the father or the mother or whatever of the great power politics. Mm. And why Britain dominates in this particular conversation? Well, because the sun never set on British Empire. Mm. And Britain did hold a tremendous amount of power, both hard power and soft power world over at the time. I mean, if you... speaking of another great conflict, India and Pakistan, and who has something to do about this, right? I mean, this is also a result of British colonialism ending in India and the partition there with a tremendous amount of human loss. And speaking another of religious...
And side note, did not that conflict give rise to Gandhi? Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and this is precisely the reason...
Okay, I'm sorry for interrupting you.
Yes, of course. So the reason for that conflict, you can make an argument, was the withdrawal of the British rule, right, the British Raj. So why Britain? Well, because Britain did have tremendous colonial holdings. And a lot of, if you even look at history of Africa and a lot of conflicts on the African continent, they also come from European powers divvying up Africa nilly-willy by people who never even stepped foot in Africa, right? Yeah. I mean, it always baffles my mind. You know, when we discuss the Pakistani example, for instance, right, that the guy who drew the partition, the line that divided Pakistani territories from Indian territories, never set foot in India until he was actually brought from Britain for this specific task. And, you know, he did this behind closed doors with nothing but, you know, ruler, pencil, and a bunch of statistics. Right, statistical numbers on the census of the populations, and that's how those decisions were being made, leading, of course, to a tremendous amount of loss of human life and the huge migration from one territory to the other because people were literally fearful for their lives of the conflict that ensued. So yeah, you know, these great powers have their place, but indeed it's a colonial conversation, right? A neo-colonial conversation. Of how do we define power, who holds that power and why, and how do they use it or abuse it. And this is right why we look to United States right now in this conflict, right? Why United States sort of now picked up the mantle and has responsibility, historical responsibility, military responsibility, however you want to call it, of coming up with some kind of solution, or at least maybe tempering tensions in this Israeli, is this particular conflict that we are living through right now. But one important thing that sort of we can look at also with the timing, why is it that late 19th century is the time of Zionism, right? It's not just something about Jewish people and the fact that they experience an injustice, it's also sort of the zeitgeist, right? Sort of the overall spirit of the day was the resurgence, or rather new insurgency of the new ideology of nationalism. Mm. And of course, Zionism is precisely that, nationalism,
yeah.
right? Jewish nationalism, that is, that nations should have a state and preferably its own. And a stateless people that indeed have suffered historical injustices and discrimination, and there's plenty of evidence to that fact, of anti-Semitism world over, deserve their nation state where they can indeed be safe and have the rule of self-determination. And this is the same time where you see a lot of nationalism in Eastern Europe, and again, and not nationalism in a bloody sense, but nationalism in a very practical sense of self-determination. So of course, any nationalism is also connected then to the loss and disintegration of empire, and hence again, British involvement in all this, carving up this new territories based upon their colonial domination and of course their own colonial rule. So here we are again talking about historical justices. And in this case, the historical justice becomes, why is it so profound again, that every generation of Israelis, every generation of Jewish people, every generation of Palestinians are impacted by their interaction. And this is why then we have this absolutely vitriolic, horrible reaction between an interaction between these peoples. When you talk about hiding behind civilians, you know, I'm reminded of Golda Meir talking about we will only find peace, she said, when they stop loving, when they start loving their children more than they hate us.
That is
a very powerful statement that sort of shows the wisdom of this woman in the sense that she recognized that this compounding generational trauma, even if we get in bringing it to today, even if there is a military success of getting rid of Hamas, the tremendous amount of trauma sustained right now, right? Not a single Palestinian has not lost someone they love. And probably in the dozens, if not hundreds of people that they were connected to. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that kind of hatred and the trauma and the reconciliation? How do you, it's going to be a very difficult process.
Yeah, it is. You know, and it goes back to, I keep going back to this in a lot of the conversations that we have around this particular table about different issues around the world. It goes back to how we understand ourselves as human beings. And the nationalist movement drove us to understand ourselves as nations, nation states, people who belonged in a particular place. And but that's kind of an artificial identification.
Indeed.
And so we draw the line here, we draw the line there. After World War I, the European nations divvied up the Middle East, and that is what we're dealing with today. It wasn't just the Brits. But because they had this colonialist mentality that we're the ones who know what to do, we're the smart ones, we're the powerful ones,
we're the civilized ones.
That's the right word, because they're the savages. And so we just did it because it's for the best for them too, even though anybody with a brain would be able to look at that and say, yeah, maybe not. But anyway, that's the way we did things. And it's led to mess after mess after mess. So we can look at India and Pakistan. We can look at the Middle East and the conflicts there. They're related to what happened 100 years ago at the time of World War I and what led up to that. So we're still not dealing with the fundamental issue of what is it about human beings that drive us to want to be in charge, to have power over others. And I don't know if we have good answers for that.
As you look at the political landscape worldwide. And it really made me think about it with the Russia-Ukrainian conflict, or the Russian aggression against Ukraine. And China, I know that President Bush just met with Chinese delegates.
President Biden.
I know you keep saying that. You do.
President Biden. Bush hasn't been in a while.
We're going to talk about that at some
point.
Some latent memories there.
I'm still picturing Bush dodge that shoe in the press conference. I was impressed by his reflexes, man.
Yeah.
Bush dodged that so smooth. But President Biden in San Francisco just sat down. And just where, from a forecasting standpoint, and it's just strictly opinion, what direction do you see some of the politics going in on a global level? Because when I look at China and what they represent to the world, and China's, it's tough to decipher, you know. And we know that they have the economic, the military, and the political might to cause some significant issues. We look at what Russia's doing, and it felt like they were kind of thumbing their nose at the international community, like, we can do what we want. And I thought, well, this is fascinating. Where do we go with that? Especially when they all made it clear, we're not okay with what you're doing. And he's like, so?
Yeah.
Where do you see all of this going?
Well, this is one of the reasons why sort of we cannot lose sight of Russia and China in this, in the greater picture of things. Because you're absolutely right. Putin is absolutely clear that his goal was to blow up international order as it is. Right, to basically, and he said that in so many words. In his numerous speeches, he said just that international order as it stands is not acceptable to the Russian Federation. So it's sort of, you can call it revanchist, revisionist, however, that policy, but it's very clear now. In terms of Chinese perspective, you know, if this could have been a really opportune moment for China to move in on Taiwan. Really opportune moment, because, right, you have one conflict in Europe that is now is losing the war in public opinion in some ways, right, because the war is prolonged. There are several op-eds appearing in the last couple of months, that unfortunate article in Times, and economists that are now sort of showing that it's going to be a long haul war where Russia is not backing down, and it's going to be drilling in. And people now started talking about sort of giving in that conflict to Russia's desires, right? Forcing Ukraine to abdicate some of its lands, which is, of course, a huge mistake, because we are indeed, by doing that, are empowering Russia in precisely the actions that it's a win.
Yeah.
It really is a win. Having Ukraine abdicate territories, forcing Ukraine to some kind of peace deal right now would be empowering not just Russia then, but also China.
Yeah.
By saying, we okay with this. Yep. And by the way, Iran too, for that matter. In the sense that, do whatever you wish. You know, if you have the military capacity and the will, the strong will do as they will, and the weak will suffer as they must. To use to quote Thucydides, but there it is. It's a complicated story, because again, we tend to compartmentalize, and unfortunately, we should not. And of course, it works to Russia's advantage. So I think that this meeting and this conversation between Biden and Xi Jinping are very well played. And very timely to bring United States perspective into the game again, to say that, yes, Israeli-Palestinian conflict is important, but as Biden very frequently likes to say, we can do both things, right? Walk and chew gum at the same time. and we're watching you, China.
Yeah.
And be careful of the actions that you're making. So you're absolutely right.
We want to be clear that in that meeting, that was President Biden, not President Bush.
Yes.
having that meeting. While we have you here, we had great discussion around the idea of destabilization. Some of the destabilization that's gone on in this own country. We look at the state of politics at home. And, you know, we had an empty speaker's chair for the first time in history. You know, you've got the internal pushings and pullings of the Republican Party, Democratic Party. I mean, all of the issues that we have going on here. I think about Russia's role with disinformation during our elections, right? And they thought, wow, the U.S. seems ripe for just throwing out some negative false bombs here or there, and you chum the waters of social media and let them take care of the rest. To some extent, it feels like there was an effectiveness to it. Destabilization seems to be, and when I asked you where is this all going in your professional opinion, that's the word that comes to mind for me, destabilization.
Yes. So look for destabilizing effects. And as a matter of fact, just yesterday or today, President Zelensky actually pointed out that they have some kind of intelligence to watch out for the Balkans as a next destabilizing place, right? Because there is another hotbed of unresolved, frozen, and generational trauma. So, you know, again, we can take him at his word, but absolutely, this could be an area of destabilization. So anywhere where there can be destabilizing actions, we should look for it. I don't want to sound alarmist, because this is like the last thing that I want to do to alarm people and to make people concerned. But again, far be it for me to sort of close eyes on big trends. Next year is going to be very important in many ways because of elections, because elections are not happening just only in the United States. It's election year in Russia as well. It's election years, right? In Ukrainian, supposed to have an election. That's going to have a conversation about that. But because of these very important political decisions, I think we need to be aware and maybe practice a little more of that informational hygiene.
I love that.
In terms of be aware of what we hear, where we're hearing it from, and for what purposes. You're absolutely right. Putin now has, Russia now has a proven track record of stirring the pot. Yes, absolutely. We now have traces of it being all over Europe, influencing public opinion, in United States, of course, influencing public opinion, and it's concerning to say the least.
Adding to the, go ahead, Chuck.
I was just going to say, I think we need to understand that there are still, in the lead up to World War II and in the aftermath, there are still a few power players at the table. And what happens worldwide, those power players look at it and make decisions about what they can take advantage of. And so they start making moves on the game board. This is the first I heard it said that this might have been a good time for China to move in on Taiwan. But it makes perfect sense.
I was about to say, when she said it, I'm thinking, like, wow, I'm glad they didn't think that, but that does make sense.
Or maybe they did, but they decided that the price was too high to pay. But,
Correct. But
there's so much going on in the world with, and especially when you add the kinds of technologies that we have today, communication-wise, so we know everything instantly that's going on out there, and technologically in terms of weapons, and we're not that far away on any given day from a really horrific conflagration. And so to be mindful of that is, I think, healthy and wise. We don't want to scare people, but we also don't want people to live with their heads buried in the sand. And so that's a fine balance, too. Look what happened in the run-up to World War II, where the Europeans said, "Nah, we'll just let Hitler have this little bit over here, and that'll appease." And then eventually we ended up with the big war. And so saying no is an important part of that, but there's a price to be paid for that. And those are always weighty decisions.
And it goes back to when you introduce Israel and any conflict going on over there, you bring in a whole different element. And it sounds like this is for a different show, but it really isn't. You know, I'm watching someone speak on television about prophecy and how, you know, prophecies are being played out before our very eyes when it comes to Israel and so on and so forth. And, you know, people are kind of poo-pooing that, like, oh, that has nothing to do with it. No, when it comes to people's strong-rooted religious feelings.
That's right.
you can't really necessarily separate that from this.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a part of it. You know, again, feeling like it's from a different show, but just can you give the listener, Chuck, a feel for how dear that is to the hearts of some people are watching strictly from that lens.
And not only are they watching based on that particular worldview, but they're also, they want to hasten some of this stuff. They want the end times to come. And so if you're of a mindset that God's going to come and fix everything when this end times set of prophecies come to fruition, then what can I do to make that happen? How can I hasten that? And so you see this with a different, from a different viewpoint than folks who say, this is terrible. And I'm not, I don't buy into, as a Christian pastor, I don't buy into the theology that says there's going to be this great, terrible end times, and then God's going to fix everything. God will do away with all the bad guys, and all the good guys will be left behind.
Which is very popular theology.
It sure is. And it's easy to see why that's the case, because it begins to feel like, well, we can't fix our own problems, so God's going to do it. That's where's my hope come from? How do I get through the day if I see this train coming at me and I have no way to stop it? So theologically speaking, we look to God to fix it for us. And that's kind of the ultimate for a particular branch, a very large branch of Christianity, that God's going to get us out of here when it gets bad, which does a couple of things. One is it can drive you to do things that might make that happen. The other is it can drive you to just sit back and watch, because this is all God stuff, not me. I don't have to do anything. So that the complacency and the apathy that it can generate, you tie all these issues together, it goes to the issue of climate change as well. Why should I do anything about the climate? God's going to fix it all. We're all going to go to heaven at some point.
You're supposed to go to pot.
We need that to happen.
Yeah.
So there's it's a destructive way of thinking, couched in religious terminology, that has to be dealt with. But that is another podcast and another show. But all of these issues are tied up, just like we're talking about Ukraine.
They're all in it. And that's the part that's so complicated. Of this, if you have a discussion about this topic, these things come into the discussion.
They do.
And I'm sure that over some of your dinner tables around a Thanksgiving time, and we're in that time of year right now.
Yeah.
The topic will come up. Somebody undoubtedly will take it from a spiritual perspective, right?
Yeah.
Somebody's going to go into whether or not we should be giving aid financially as a country, and all of these things
absolutely
are going to be said as you pass the roast beast.
Yeah, exactly right.
You know, and so that's the thing that fascinates me. I think about the millennials and the younger people who I even hate to frame it as are making a lot of pro-Palestinian statements and things along those lines. I think for a lot of younger people in this country, they see and identify predominantly with the human aspect of this, being someone who works around young people on a regular basis. You know, give us a sense of that from your perspective.
Yes, I can see that, especially on some other college campuses, around this country. It's been quite interesting to observe that trend. And I wonder, yes, that it's, I think you're correct, that there is a identification with the underdog as they perceive, the oppression that they see. And of course, this being a generation very much connected into the movements of social justice, and of course, social media that attribute and helps them to sort of, helps them or hinders them. I wonder which one is better here to use to actually comprehend the fullness of the situation. Mm-hmm. And of course, that maybe youthful, but again, I don't want to make that completely a young person issue, but desire to do something, to stand for the just cause, right? And to be supporting the, as I said, the underdog, the one that's being the oppressed. But you know, the curious thing about this particular conflict and its resolution, that it will have to be a political solution.
Mm.
Just like in Ukrainian war, political will have to be a political solution. And we cannot solve this militarily. And unfortunately, right now, the rhetoric coming from the Israeli government and from their perspective, they don't have that solution. They don't have that political solution. Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't seem to have a political goal in mind. His military aim of destroying Hamas is quite clear, but political aim of what do you do the next day is not there. And that's a very important lesson and a very important point that I think in U.S. policymakers, I'm sure, are thinking this through, given their own experiences in the Middle East, mm-hmm. given Afghanistan, given Iraq. We have to sort of remember what happens the next day, what's the plan, and what's then the plan of leaving,
mm-hmm.
right? If the military and when the military campaign does succeed, what is the civilian solution? What is the political solution? Because you cannot, right? What was this, Colin Powell who said to Bush at the time? See how I brought him back?
There you go.
Yeah, I think it was Colin Powell who told President Bush at the time that, you know, about Iraq, that if you break it, you own it, you buy it, right?
Yeah.
And this is the situation here too. What is the degree to which Israel is willing to go with the Palestine? What is this going to look like? If it's a two-state solution, what does it look like? If it's not a two-state solution, what does it look like? And those are the questions that we don't have answers for at the moment, which makes this conversation that much more poignant, because the military campaign continues, to your point about, again, people taking sides, especially younger people wanting that resolution and not seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Chuck, you brought it into it earlier, and you know, as we start heading toward the finish line here, at some point, the world looked at Hitler and as this rabid animal that just needed to be put down. Like, okay, we've seen enough at this point. What choice do we have but to just go ahead and put him down? When I look at the influence and the role of Hamas, is that the conclusion that the powers that be will come to with Hamas? Because it does feel like that particular group has a goal, and they don't seem to want to move off that goal.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that goal grows out of their sense of injustice when the Israelis moved in and in the 40s and through this 20th century to take over that land. They feel like they were dispossessed, and now they feel like they have a right to their anger and to fight back. And so I kind of get that, but they're simply a terrorist organization who has the interest of no particular people in mind except for themselves. They are not advocates for the Palestinian people. They want power, and they're just going to hold on to that power and govern however they want. And I mean, it's just going to be a mess if Hamas is not dealt with. So I don't know. I don't know when or even how the world says we're going to come against Hamas, because they're not like Hitler was, who was the chancellor of a nation that we could defeat. How do you defeat Hamas?
And what is more then, right, go into the generational trauma.
Yep.
And we know very well you deal with like a many-headed monster, right, because it comes from the very deep-seated anger and hatred. You destroy Hamas, what is the guarantee that next Hamas is not there? And this is
exactly right.
The point of the day after plan, right? What is that day after plan going to look like, and what is that policy going to look like to prevent that kind of sort of reckoning or emergency of another terrorist organization? And you know, you can make an argument again to your point about the youngsters being pro-Palestinians, and we already made that connection that Hamas is not Palestine, Palestine is not Hamas. But we can have that conversation also about what is the sort of the just course of action, when enough is enough. You know, that old expression of somebody's freedom fighter, somebody's terrorist. And I think this is again where we might get or our younger generation, as you say, of people might get conflated stories about what really is the who's the terrorist and who is the freedom fighter.
It seems like go ahead, Chuck.
No, go.
It seems like every clip I watch, was looking at something on Yasser Arafat the other day, and it just seemed like clip after clip after clip of watching him with some mediator, having him shake hands with somebody. And this is, it just seems to be the never-ending conflict.
Yeah, and even when you make some progress. So you have Sadat in Egypt, and they make some agreements, and they make some what looked like progress, and then the not the terrorists, but the radicals just take him out. And then what was the Israeli leader? Was it Peres? No, it wasn't Peres. It was Yitzhak Rabin, who was also part of negotiating and making progress, and he was assassinated. And so it's, there's radical elements all through the Middle East that have a vested interest in there not being peace. Yeah. You talk about destabilization. The question that came to my mind was, who benefits from the destabilization?
That's always the question,
we've always got to look at that. So we do this at this table a lot. What are we gonna do about this? I don't know.
It's
something that you can, I think from my perspective, you can look at Israel and you can say, I understand there needs to be, that need to be in a safe place and to protect themselves. But how can I not look at the Palestinians and not have compassion for them as well? And if you have two or three generations now, you got several generations of Palestinians who've lived in and grown up in refugee camps. I mean, of course they're going to be angry. So you got all these young men, there's no work for them, and they're angry. What do you expect to happen?
Right. All right. Well, this is a difficult topic. I appreciate you both taking time. Dr. Sersko Harnett, thank you so much for taking time to come and talk to us about a very sensitive topic. Chuck, as usual, thank you so much for co-hosting. And thank you, the listener, for giving us an hour of your day to allow us to not necessarily unpack, but to analyze this very difficult issue, no matter where your leaning stand or where your opinions fall on this particular topic. That's it for our show today. You can tune in next time for more discussion and analysis with local and national guests. Remember that Next 2.0 streams on Fridays on all major podcast platforms and the fourth Sunday of the month at 4 p.m. on WQLN NPR, which is 91.3 FM. I'm Marcus Atkinson. Come and join us again so that you hear about what's next for our communities and our democracy. Peace.